Damn!
I'm talking about a side of violence. Everything that isn't me is violent.
And, we might start on all the different rates and magnitudes and decisions of metaphysical, externally and externally, metaphysically and physically, and how we might intercept various events and shunt them angularly into holding patterns to be then, as I said, for instance, the waters, which we need very badly to live, yet they come in rains and so forth, may not accommodate our pattern of using them. So we shunt them in holding patterns, then valve them into our presence and magnitudes and frequencies that suit us. I find that all design in the universe seems to reduce itself to angle and frequency modulation. Really seems pretty extraordinary that you can reduce things that much, but that seems to be it. As chemists or whatever you may be studying, I think you can find it solid that we go such. There's always an observer, and he has an axis of reference for the observer, maybe between his eyes and his feet. It must be, in order to have any angular direction, we have to have something of reference, so there must be some axis of reference. And that is the axis of whatever is chosen by observer. And in relation to that original axis, then, we proceed at some angle, and for so many frequencies, then we change angle for so many frequencies. You find that you can describe anything that is angle frequency in relation to the original axis. The original axis then requires a two-ness. I say north pole and south pole, or heaven and feet. I've tried to review time and again with myself what it is that self can consciously identify with it is really experiencing. As for instance, I've tried to identify what it is that I personally do consciously when we say we think. The great deal of it's very, very involuntary. What do I personally put in? So we hear people say he has a bright idea. I don't think that we are empty milk bottles and suddenly something starts flashing in there. I don't think that's the way it works at all. But we do become, we're intrigued and we say, what was that? That was experience. How does it relate to something else? When you say, what was it? You've got to identify it. Now, number one, I will say that I've often tried to think about what was my first memories. I'm sure all of you have. What's the first one? I would say that I can catch on to anything I describe, the earliest thing I can describe is always described in the terms of an earlier experience. That is hotter, is taller, sweeter, whatever it is, than something before. The consciousness really is comparative. As constant comes in, it was comparative. This is not what I had before. God forbid, and the child does that right quickly. He doesn't like it, he doesn't have it before. So, I would say consciousness begins with otherness. I'm going to do something. I also, as I explore personally, I feel that they are very fundamental sounds that relate to very fundamental experiences. And when you listen to it, in fact, we know that any child can learn any of the languages men have developed. A child can grow up in any 150 known languages. But when that child, before it starts to learn your language, if you listen to a child in his crib in the morning, he starts really babbling along. And I think you put possibly in some of your early memories going back to where you yourself going, you're just fine. Oh! Can you remember? That's a little tiny bit of really experimenting with sound, I'm sure you can. And children make very fundamental sounds. I've traveled around the world already. The Zulus and the Swazi in South Africa still talk in a very beautiful way. It's spoken of by the Europeans as the clicks. And the clicks, they are...
Here, let me take that. You're not supposed to drink until I talk, right?
That's a good way of talking. The clicks they use in their language. It's very musical, really. And children have that full range of sounds. And most of our languages we're familiar with have given up a lot of those. And many of the languages we are familiar with do then develop from people in a cold country where maybe you don't want to get your mouth too wet, but you freeze to death, you keep your mouth pretty well closed. Or it's a very dusty country. And the people who have fish diets, and they're a little different from others. The very fact, for instance, the Icelandic, the very northerly people can say father, father, and you get over on the continent where you found they couldn't say, they say father. And then other people can't say that, they say but. You get a great deal of interaction between B's and D's and V's. And the Russians say Balkansky or Bal, or maybe Volkansky. These are really what you can do. And so there've been alliterations creeping into all of our communication and limitations, and we've sort of gone down to relatively few that fairly easily cross communicable between people with sort of limitations of the way they talk to it. I've been very interested personally then getting back to the fact that children start talking a kind of language of their own. I think we ought to make a lot of tape recordings of children babbling in their own rooms in the early morning. They're just really full of it. They're practically singing. And it sounds a lot like the birds. I think we have taken a lot of tape recordings of the birds and the whales and the porpoises and the children. There's a possibility we may really get back to something I might call a universal language. And I personally have always felt that would be so we say, sort of question, And then you say, I like it. I'm sure that those sounds are very much, I think that, for instance, I give you the other. It's almost the beginning of a talking, uttering, and other and so forth. I say, mum, and mummy. There's really sort of the thing you like, and I can, so I get the mum, mother. You see, really, I use that kind of clue, whether the etymologist may not go along with you, but the point says you really are safe to jump thousands and millions of year gaps to really try to get back to something very spontaneous and near the beginnings. Anyway, I spoke about what it is I'm conscious of doing when I'm thinking. First place, I said, I won't think or have consciousness without the otherness. Then that otherness gives me, at least me and the other, and that gives us an axis of reference of the mind. I wonder how this sort of spontaneous axis of reference does develop, is being yourself and the prominent other. Now, What I'm personally conscious of about the thinking, so I've gone back at it, is the following. In this place, there is something that charmed me into wanting to consider it. When I do think, it's because I say there's something urgent about it. I want to think about that, but I don't initiate that urgency. That is coming out of my subconscious reflexing. There's something prominent I still insist on. I intuitively pay attention to. I pay greater attention to what I call intuition. And my intuition, I mean. No, you take your two fingers like that and carry them around. Just do this, all of you. And watch your two fingers, and you'll find that you still see your two fingers out here. But you can decide when I'm looking at you, and you don't think about what you're seeing over here. Otherwise, we'd continually say, I'm looking at you. But we have so much of this kind of subconscious over here that if something were coming this way, you would do that. But we are keeping track of all that very wide range all the time, subconsciously.
And there's a lot.
Even though we think we say, I'm going to keep even narrower range. With like just taking a lens on the camera, I've really got a seemingly a long distance lens, so I'm just like getting you there. But I've really got this other set of lenses still operative all the time. I learned to remember when my first job, I had an accounting job, and I was counting, adding up very long columns. An auditor came along to me and said, I see you being very, very careful, so I don't want to make a mistake. You got 56 and 7 is 63. You're looking at all that. Checking back very consciously. He said, you're so familiar with the table of addition, and your subconscious is so absolutely competent in this matter. Like the whole of counting has been evolved through what is really apprehendable spontaneously and so forth. The whole naming of the numbers that way. It goes way back in our reflexes for thousands of years. So he said, if you will dare do it, like a surfer, don't say 56 and 7 is 63. You simply say 56, 63. You find your subconscious already has added up. You're bringing a consciousness in to do what you've already done subconsciously. So he said, like a surfer, you get up on the edge and just start reading the numbers down. You find that you really can do it. You're going to be rather scared because you like to be very accurate, but you'll find it absolutely easy to go right down just what is the top number. The cumulative will always be waiting on your tongue. And so he said, dare do it and go through your column. You can go through your column three times rather going through once the way you're doing it. And if you come through twice and you come out the same way, put it down and you're probably very safe. So I found it really was then. We do have beautiful subconscious apprehending capabilities, always right operating. That you and I are very, very cautious, and we've seen it already, and yet we'll verify it in a slow way. Now, having discovered then that you do have subconscious operative capability, great reliability, it's really going on all the time. I just want to introduce that into the dialogue when I'm talking about intuition. And intuition is then that our subconscious is really putting things together. You and I in this room, you've got a whole lot of things already been put together. And probably some very good conclusions about what we're experiencing already. Each one of you have. But you say, I'm disciplining myself. I'm going to learn something now. I'm just really listening. But the point is, this other thing is going on. Okay. When I talk about intuition, I'll then also point out to you that we go to sleep and we wake up, we do dream. That's part of our experience. I'm talking about a twilight zone between really being conscious and not conscious. in their subconscious. I'm certainly no, because time and time again, as an explorer and asking questions, being puzzled, I go to bed putting the questions into my head and wake up with the answer list very, very beautifully sharp. Although something's been going on cooking all the time, I thought I was sleeping.
Talking about cooking, excuse me. May I offer you some tea for a moment and ask you if it's too chilly, because it's rather hot in here and I've opened the door.
I don't.
Do you feel the draft?
I was unaware.
Well, that's why I want to bring it to your attention. Does it feel all right?
Yeah,
I'm sorry to.
I have a heavy suit. Yes.
All right.
I don't know about everybody else. Fine.
All set. Okay. Yeah. Okay, you can reach it. When is a good time to cut? We're about 15 minutes out, and I want to build something into your continuing development. Can you tell me?
If you think that. I may not be giving a satisfaction because some of you really want something very specific.
No, that's
you,
not.
You tell me.
No.
But otherwise, I've now started to build something for you.
Thank you. Okay, and so we'll go ahead.
I'm really, my life is such that I'm meeting a great many people. And I have also myself just so much time to do this. I really learned to develop strategies of how I'll cope with the problem. And I'm subconsciously already organized something here. I think I might as well pursue it rapidly. And I'll get it done better without the interruption. Conscious of the room and the school, and that you do have. I mean, you're a beautiful human being, so just sit there and let me look at your eyes. I want to then point out that there is a twilight zone between our being conscious and not being conscious. Yet there's something we now have ample testimony that we really do carry on subconsciously. So what I call intuition is that sudden awareness of the subconscious are trying to tell you something. Now, intuition has turned out to be a very important kind of a phenomenon. When I was young, I found these scholars considering the word intuition practically the word indicating absolute stupidity. There was no such thing. There really was a very hard school of pragmatism and so forth coming out of Harvard. So there was really a great disdain for the word intuition as being, these are soft, romantic people, they don't know what they're talking about. But there was a very interesting two men, Northrop at Yale, and for the moment I forget the name of the other man, quite independently, decided it would be worthwhile looking into the letters and diaries, all the written data there was available, of a chosen set of men who made very great scientific contributions. And they chose the diaries and letters and so forth of those men that were available to study, where they looked at what they were writing before they made the great discovery, just before they made the great discovery, say a week, starting a month or so ahead, and at the time they made of it, and then for a little while after. And they also looked at the letters of their friends, their families, their wives, trying to get the dialogue that was going on of that man, hoping that they might find in this because they're starting before the discovery is made, so the man doesn't know he's going to make it. Trying to catch him unaware, really disclosing what might be some of the most important factors. They hoped that they might, each of these explorers, Northrop and the other man, deliberately hoped they might find something in common that was experienced by
all those great men that might be identified with making great discoveries. And both Northrop and the other man, I say, operating completely independently and on completely independent initiatives, not knowing the other man was doing it, did cover this, employ the same strategy, and they both made the same discoveries. They all discovered, in the common to all of them, are these great discoverers, was their statement that the single most important factor in the great discovery was intuition. And the second most important factor was the second intuition, about 45 seconds after the first one. It uncovered something for you. You suddenly got a fish, and there's a nibble. What did you do? Go and light a cigarette and say, that's very interesting, a nibble. Or did you really pull it in? Did you really land that fish for society? And so there are two intuitions. There's really something like that other than this. There seems to be sort of fundamental two-ness in here of great importance about human beings. And so the ones who really caught something for society did then set up a strategy question. And they said, being methodical is important, but any method will do as long as you're methodical. But they said, if your second intuition was the wrong one about what you ought to do, and you went in 180-degree error, there's no use, you just never recovered. So they happened to go in the right direction. Didn't make a 180-degree error. As they say, that's all there is about it. Now, intuition, and was these two intuitions, the only thing they found in common, any of that literature. So it's a very important word. In other words, it was that man having all these special case experiences, which our brain is storing, suddenly the mind being aware there's some new pattern, there's something going on between here and not of. That's what intuition spots. And there's some commonality. Okay. Now, I've introduced that in our talk about thinking. Now, I'll also give you then experience we all have, every one of us, relation to the brain, and the brain storing each special case experience. Then our brain seems to work very much like a moving picture, or rather television director's headquarters, who has a number of screens out here. No man has actually ever seen outside himself. The information comes in and it's really actually being seen in the brain. We tend very much to put our experience out where we see it. You tend to say, I see you over here, but you're really seeing me in your television set back in the brain, in the direction headquarters. So in this headquarters, in the coming, the live news pictures, smellies and feelies, they're all coming in all the time and into the brain here. And you have all these screens. And so I say, hey, something's going on here, but I've experienced this before. So immediately a documentary group go to work and they say, yes, here it is. Or you've never seen it before. Then you say, I got a scenario department over here. If I haven't seen it before, what ought I do? Or if I have seen it before, what scenario department should. So you put that in, that's the one you put out there on the screen there for the action. Now, recalling then that we really are dealing in these extraordinary documentaries are the special case experiences, the ingredients that all the time go back to the individual special case experience we've had. All right. You and I have experienced time and again. So what's our friend's name? You remember? You know that big red-headed character? What was it? I wish I could say. And tomorrow morning, suddenly you remember that friend's name. And you're in the middle of a conversation with somebody else who's really quite annoying, and I'm not there to speak to, but you're really annoyed you got it. And maybe tomorrow afternoon I get it. We all experience a lag in rate of recallability, particularly of names. But it may not necessarily be the name of a man. the names themselves of human beings used to be very descriptive. He was a smith because he was smiting. He was a miller because he was milling. But those same men are not doing that anymore, so the names do no longer tend to bring about a functional kind of memory. So they simply represent actually a memory about S and an M and an I and a T. It's a kind of a drawing. And we have so many of that kind of past experience, it's quite a little time for us to recall. And apparently that area where we store that kind of special case pattern, it gets very filled up. It takes a long time before the searching gets down to find it. But just as I sit here talking to you, or you talk to me, you say, I want to use the right word. I mean chisel. I don't mean a knife. I mean chisel. And they're the right words, the nuanced words. You take a little time to remember those. Oh, so we. You get to think about it, there's rates of recallability, relative rates of recallability. But all of it has some lag. It's not instantaneous. Now this goes back to the beginning of awareness of otherness, because in order to have an otherness, we really introduce time. We introduce a lag because there was another experience, now I have this one. It's comparative. It's very interesting that man, in developing a word, inventing a word which we consider the minimum increment of time, he called it a second. And the second means a second experience. The time, the very description of a minimum time unit is a second experience, a second and a second. I want you to realize that the poetry of this kind of, because poetry again is a very intuitive formulating of the right sound to really identify that kind of experience. Okay. So our very thinking process and its lags introduce the phenomenon of time into an eternal universe, to a timeless universe. Where I find that all of our consciousness, because it has lags and after images, is always just a little inaccurate. Everything about humanity, as Heisenberg begins to find it, is able to show you, just that there is an inherent inaccuracy. You can tolerate a little less error, but you'll always be just a little short of the absolute truth. And this sort of quality of the phenomenon life itself, which is this time introduction of this, it is life. It seems to be sort of relative imperfection. It's just an approximation. Now, remembering then about these lags, and I talk about what it is I do when I think. I say I'm intuitively interested in trying to find a relationship between two things. I can't quite make those connections. That's what provokes me. I can't make the connection. Yet I intuit there is some kind of connection. So what I do when I personally, consciously about the thinking part is I say, I'm trying to think about it and then I think about something else. There's suddenly an intrusion. That's irrelevant what I'm thinking about. So what is that intrusion? I'm sure you all do what I do. I'm walking down the street and I say, what's the name of that tree? My mother told me to name that tree. My mother was wonderful about trees. And then suddenly something else, automobile splashes, you forget you asked about that tree. But the point is that our subconscious is such that once we've asked what's the name of that tree, the searching starts right in. And it's the name. And you're trying to go to sleep at night and we find that the lags are not really identifiable. There's all kinds of magnitudes of lag. So you're trying to go to sleep and in come maple trees and so forth. But whether you're just trying to go to sleep or not, when I'm trying to think about the relationship between these two things, and then comes the maple tree or whatever it is. But I know that I consciously do, when we say I'm concentrating, my posture is to say, And for the moment, I'm holding out that irrelevancy. I know it's a very interesting item that's come to my thoughts, but I like to keep it in the ante room for the moment, outside. In this room, I just wanted to keep these two things that are puzzling me. So my conscious part of thinking is my conscious holding out of irrelevancies, holding to one side. That really takes kind of a cofferdam kind of operation. You're kind of doing this kind of fast, like swimming, putting the water aside so it won't get in there. You're trying to really keep it scooped out so you can see what's in there. It takes a lot of work. That's my conscious part of thinking. And once I've discovered what my conscious part is, again, I find it's very important to identify something I call dismissing irrelevances. Once I've recognized that my conscious part is dismissing irrelevances, I then discover the irrelevances fall into two main classes. I'm continually rewarded by finding how we go from the oneness you identify into a two-ness. And the irrelevances fall into two main classes. All the experiences you've had, which are too large and too infrequent to have any pertinency, any relevancy, the thing you're trying to think about. The size of the thing you're trying to think about are this size. And really, this has nothing to do with novae. Novae don't occur, really, I can dismiss it, novae. This being a star exploding. They don't explode often enough to have anything to do with the frequency involved between the two things I'm talking about. They're happening, you know, every couple of days. Then I find the relevances fall into also, then that's a macrocosmic group. They're too big and too infrequent, and they're too small and too high frequency to have any discernible differentiability. I find that there really is a tunable set. Again, our friend angle and frequency begins to come in. It's the right magnitude. It feels as right. So inasmuch as our experiences, which we dismiss as irrelevant, that as a child, you're in the womb and your mother's walking around and now Earth is spinning and it's going orbiting around the sun, so that the observations even of the mother were omnidirectional, but then you and I, our experiences just inherently omnidirectional. Therefore, when I dismiss irrelevances, I don't have any recourse that omnidirectionally dismissed. Outwardly, the big ones are too big, outwardly, and the small ones are inwardly. This then gives me some geometry. I didn't expect it, but suddenly there's a geometry. There's a zone of lucid relevance, and it's spherical. Some sort of polyhedron there. There's some stars in here. Yes, I'm interested in this star. Those are the things I'm trying to find out about. And with the having then this really sort of insiders and outsiders and zone of lucid relevancy, then there gets to be sort of twilight zones of tantalizingly almost relevant. Maybe this counts. And so there has to be a twilight, microcosmic twilight and a macrocosmic twilight in the spherical dismissal. Very interesting, this thing all generates itself if you're being faithful, taking some time, just being faithful, what does your experience? So suddenly I came then to what I thought, I'm quite confident, is really might call thinkability, is then the lucidly relevant set. So when I'm standing up talking, as I did last night or with you now, I really do very quickly begin to feel we have just so much time. And there's some things that are very, very important we might really talk about. And I feel, for instance, intuition is very important to talk about what thinking is about. And can I get this in the magnitude of the time we're dealing in? Is it relevant? So I have to think absolutely what's relevant in this room to the time that I have. That's the size I'm dealing in. Okay. So suddenly a geometry has been developed. You mean it? But if we begin to find thought really is a sort of a geometrical affair with an enormous macrocosmic irrelevancy and a microcosmic irrelevancy. And there's really this right tuning right down to now and the kind of frequency we're palpitating in here, and the kind of minutes we have. We have just our kind of days on our planet, and then we're down to the amount of time you have with us in the school we have in this room. Okay, so there's very powerful frequency modulation going on there. Now, I began then, this made me say, I'm dividing the whole universe, that you and I have the competence to take total universe. My definition of universe is the aggregate of all humanity's consciously apprehended and communicated experiences. I want to operate, not axiomatically, but operate entirely in the terms of experience. I find my own, when I decided to do my own thinking, meant I must go to my own experiences. When I said, I'm not going to believe anymore, my grandmother said, Don, you don't know about this, but I'm personally persuaded these people are very, knew what they were talking about. It's a very impressive, extraordinary thing, this religious information, and I want you to believe it. And I love you very much, you know, I know you love me, you're just going to have to trust me that my judgment says this is something you ought to believe. That's it. I took on an enormous amount of that when I was young. But then I found it got me in so much trouble that I decided I would really have to go to my own experience. And when I got to the experience, basically, then come, for instance, it is James Jeans, who is a very competent thinker, explorer, and scientific historian. So James Jeans said, there are many definitions of science. He said, by science, I mean the earnest attempt to set in order the facts of experience. The raw material was experience, and what you put in is to try to find some order. I find Ernst Mach, who was a great Viennese physicist, his name is used for Mach number. Of sonic speed and supersonic speed. Ernst Mach said, physics is the attempt to set experience in most economical order. He said it's completely independent of genes. I'm sure they were unaware of one another. But here you have, the physicist finds nature always, she has a number of alternatives, but she always takes one of the equally most economical. So the difference really the physicist against the general scientist was he's looking for the economy of order. Another scientist could look for order even though it's not very economical. That you go, there is a way of going roundabout it too. And so to get into Boolean algebra, what you call reductio ad absurdum, when you can't make a logical deduction, then you make a you get dismissed, take the most absurd things and get those out of the way. And then you have sort of a residue of not too absurd. And so I want to point out that this would be not the most economical way, possibly. So the difference between a physicist and a general scientist would be the physicist is concerned about the economy. Because it's his experience, if you're really catching on to what nature's doing, he's always doing the most economical way. So physicists are trying to find out how nature's doing. Okay. I find Einstein saying the beginning and the end is experience. Over and over again, you'll find really great men, the raw material of science is experience. And the difference between mathematicians, we've known them, and the rest of the scientists. One reason mathematicians get lower